Good evening. Welcome to Turfgrass Epistemology. Hope you're having a wonderful day, or had a wonderful day. The week is coming to an end. I think this might be the first time I've done it on a Thursday night. It's actually very nice. I'll do the normal week in the mornings, and then I have a little bit of a break, and I'll do Thursday night. It's very nice. Until football comes around. When Thursday night football comes around, I'll have to make another change, I think. But I'm Travis Shaddix. This is Turfgrass Epistemology. We're on the search for how we know what we know about turfgrass science. We've been talking about potassium. We're going to continue talking about potassium for the remainder of the month. And tonight's going to be as more or less a overall lecture sort of episode where I'm going to be giving a show on potassium that I would give to a live audience as a means to introduce the topic of potassium in terms of its interaction with stress on turf grass. So there'll be a number of papers, but it'll all be like just, you know, some of the key results from each paper that I would show at a, say, a conference or something. And so look forward to that. We have a video as well, so we'll go into that. Good evening, Gray. Chuck Benzing. Yeah, State of the Unions tonight. So if you're watching me, you're probably in the same wavelength as I am when it comes to those sorts of politics. Andrew Burse, welcome, Super TA. You're very welcome, Super TA. He says, something worth watching tonight, as always. Thanks for all you do. Thank you for coming and watching. You've been here since the very beginning, Super TA. Somebody, in the very beginning when I started the show, of course, I gave two or three, well, you can go back and look. I did two or three episodes with no one here. I was just speaking to the universe by myself, I guess. And then somebody showed up. I can't remember if it was you, Super TA, or if it was Aldo, or I don't remember. You can go back and look at the original episodes. But then one person showed up, and then the next episode, so maybe two people showed up, and it stayed like that for quite a while. And now normally there's 30 or 40 that come and watch it live. So I'm glad to hear that you appreciate my time and my efforts to help the turfgrass industry gain better knowledge, critical thinking skills, and best management practices, and find our way through some nonsense, which we will see tonight in a video. I was asked to review a product which I'd never heard of, and I'm gonna have a video on that tonight. Shaddix at 9, Celtics at 10. Oh, you're Connecticut, Cubonic, and you're up in the Boston area, I guess. So yeah, I don't know. John Fetter, I'm happy that you're here. Thank you for coming. LW50, TGF crew checking in. TGF crew? What is that? I'm slow. The grass factor? Is that what that is? And Ignacio Pais, I always catch the replay in sections. Yeah, that's sort of the way it was. It is intended, Ignacio. I really appreciate everybody showing up and participating live. It makes me a little bit more passionate about coming and being here on time and knowing that there's people wanting to gain this information. I definitely appreciate that. But also, for those people who just want to hang out and listen to it for 20 minutes at a time, 10 minutes at a time, driving to work, driving back, whatever it is on a podcast, whether you're driving around town or out shoveling, out mowing the yard or spreading fertilizer, whatever it is, you can just watch 10 or 15 minutes or listen 10 or 15 minutes at a time. That's a good way to do it too. So, Ignacio, so one thing he says, one thing my channel has done, Turfgrass Epistemology channel has done, is made me appreciate the power of marketing. And you will see more of that tonight in a video. So let me get into it, because I got a little bit to go into tonight. So I received maybe on Monday or Wednesday this week, or maybe it was last week, I don't even remember when, somebody in the chat or some people in the chat had asked me to review a product, and I mentioned to them I had no idea what that was. And I asked them to send me an email, and they did. A couple people did, actually. So let me read these emails real quick. I left the identification information out of here, but those people who wrote the email, if you're in chat tonight, if you want me to mention your name, I'm happy to do it. I just left it out because you sent me an email. Just on that note, if you send me an email, I'm not going to put your personal information or who, you know, what you, I'm not going to let people know that that's this, you're the person that wrote the email. If you put it in public chat, then I'll use that and just, you know, I'm assuming if it's in public chat, you don't care. But if you send me a private email, don't worry about me, you know, putting it on the show and identifying who you are, because my intention is not to violate any trust that way. But if you want me to, if you prefer I mention you and you think I'm leaving you out on purpose, that's not my intent. I'm just doing it to, you know, a sense of some sort of ethical boundary. I don't want to violate any confidence with you. Anyway, so the email says, "Good evening, Dr. Shaddix. I'm curious on your take on a product called Armament. It's a potassium acetate mainly coated on fertilizer prills. It's being pushed by distributors now in my area in New England. I'm a business owner of a lawn care business with 612 customers. I also run the channel Blank. I'm good friends with Blank. I'm also Blank on the Grass Factor Discord. We have acidic pH 4.2 and to 5.0 soils on most lawns here in their area. Thank you for your feedback. I love the content and would love to work with you in the future." And then I got another email and it says, "Good afternoon, Dr. Shaddix. This is Blank. This is the product that one of the audience members inquired about in the chat during your last show." This is the person who emailed me after I asked them to email me. I didn't know what they're talking about. "Last year when I purchased grass seed, I remember the salesman pushing this product and recommended that I put it down 4 to 6 weeks after I overseeded. I don't remember the exact NPK, but it was in the realm of a 2408 with Armament. Here's a link from YouTube. I didn't buy it, but it sounded familiar when it was mentioned in the chat. See you Monday." And then he put a link in here. Okay. And if you want me to mention your name, I will. I don't mean to leave you out or not give you credit for the email. If you prefer, let me know in the chat and I will mention who did it. Otherwise, let's go to the video. This is like a 6 or 7 long minute video, which I don't have the patience to sit through. So I'm going to skip through it. I have some timestamps, but I'm going to use this as an example of, well, there's several examples of fallacies in this marketing video. But primarily, I'm going to use it as an example of the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy, where it means after this, therefore, because of this. And it's extremely common in human nature to assume that what you're seeing is a result of what you did. And marketing is full of it, literally and metaphorically. I mean, they're just loaded with this fallacy. They'll say, "Well, you did this and that happened, therefore that caused that," right? And they love seeing stuff on Facebook and Twitter where people say, "Hey, look what I applied and look how good my lawn is, look how good my fairway is and my football field looks fantastic." And they love seeing that, even though they have no idea whether or not it actually resulted in that outcome. They love that because they're convinced that people will, you know, believe it and buy it. And they probably will. A lot of people will. So I'm going to use this video tonight as an example of the post hoc, it's a post hoc fallacy, but it's the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. But there's several other ones in there. So we'll get to it. I don't know if I'm going to get through it. I'm going to try my best to get through this thing fast. Where am I at here? Internet. Because it's a long video. 6-7 minutes. I'm going to try to cut it down to like 3. I'm going to try to keep my mouth shut on this too, but you know me. I'm going to have to speak up and say something at some point. Where am I at? Okay, here we go. Let's listen to it and I will move it ahead in timestamps to kind of make this thing as short as I can. The title is called Armament Technology by a website called, or a YouTube account called Foliar Pack.
Hi. I'm Kurt Guerin with Foliar Pack, and I'm here to talk about Armament Technology, specifically how it helps manage the difficult soils we encounter in many lawn care situations.
Okay, so one of the other things marketing loves to do is they love to create a problem that doesn't exist. Okay. Even if it sort of is common in the sort of the realm of turfgrass science or the realm of agronomy, or we do have bad soils. Clearly there are soils that are difficult to grow plants in, but you have to create a problem if you're going to sell a product to fix it. And so one of the key steps in marketing is to create a problem, whether it exists or not. And so they're going to create a problem here that probably exists in some situations. But that's, keep in mind that even you might not have a situation. And even if you do have this situation, then we'll go to the next step, which is, well, how do you know this product's actually going to cure the turf grass in the situation? So let's get into it. We'll go to the next 40 seconds ahead. Here we go.
For growing medians, here are some of the parameters of healthy soils that are often lacking. We see poor aggregate stability, which leads to poor soil structure. This also leads to poor airspace and limited water holding capacity. Bulk density is too high. Soil organic matter is too low, and this results in limited biological activity. Mineral balance is out of whack, and pH is too. So we often deal with less than ideal measurements in some, if not all, of these parameters.
Now, I just realized I didn't put that on the main screen, but that's okay. You guys can see it. I think you heard it. I've been growing grass and mowing grass since, I'm going to say, I'm going to say 1983, 84, something like that. When I was a young child, I would help Jesse Deere from the church go around and mow lawns when I was 7 or 8 years old. And then I helped Delbert Toddy mow lawns. And I mowed my own lawns and pushed that lawnmower up and down the sidewalk, getting money to go skiing in Colorado. I mowed lawns to get money to go do. That's what it was. My thing was skiing in Colorado. So I've been mowing grass a long time. Okay. And I can say with my experience that I have ran into air situations where the soil is problematic, but it is not that common. I mean, I've grown grass from Oklahoma to Florida to Kentucky, and you know, maybe I'm lucky, I don't know, but it's not that common. You know, you do have obviously situations. I'm sure everybody here listening has had a situation where you've had a bad soil here or there, but they're acting like this is a huge problem where you have aggregate stability is a problem and available water is a problem. Bulk density is a problem. That's a key sign of a BSer right there is you have the soil's too compacted. Well, how do you know that? You know, have you even done a physical soil test on it yet? They have to create problems. Just keep in mind that you might have, let's say you have 1,000 lawns, you're probably going to have a couple of lawns in there that have some poor soils. There's no question about it, but it's not that common. Okay. So don't get overly convinced that, you know, the world's coming to an end and this fear mongering is legitimate. Don't let it bother you. If you have a soil problem, then there, you know, we can work on it, but don't be overly convinced that you actually do have a soil problem. And then moreover, even if you do have a soil problem, what's the likelihood that they're going to have a product that solves it? Okay, let's look into it. We're going to skip ahead to 337. Here we go. So they have a product, and they've created, in your mind at least, or attempted to create a problem. Now, if you're convinced you have a problem, they've got you in a position where now they can sell you a cure for that problem. Right, even if you don't actually have the problem. So let's look into it. Here we go.
So Armament is really a biodegradable nutrient enhancer, patented technology, and when used on a regular basis along with routine fertilizer applications, you're going to get a better balance of nutrition to that plant. In the end, you'll see deeper, stronger roots and more resilient turf, and definitely a longer lasting color.
Now, all of those are claims that can be measured. Deeper roots, longer lasting color, all of those are easily measured. It's not difficult at all to measure that stuff. So I'm sure they're actually going to show us evidence, right? They're going to actually show it. Cause we can go out this there and do this in a season, find out what deeper roots and longer lasting color. We could do that in a season. No problem. Very little effort. So I'm sure they did it, right? Let's check it out.
Here is a good example of how ARMA works in the field.
This is a good example of what post hoc ergo prop hoc fallacy looks like. That's exactly what this looks like. So I did this and that happened. Therefore, it must have caused it. Meanwhile, I could create that. Everybody here watching this can go out right now. Well, maybe not now, but tomorrow and create this photo without applying a single ounce of fertilizer or any element. You can do that right now. This is very easy to fake. It's not difficult. But even if it wasn't fake, there's no way to know whether or not that the product actually resulted in this. So you got to be real careful because it's very easy. Like these pictures say 1,000 words. So this must be convincing. It must work. Don't be fooled. Okay. This is a very, very common fallacy that it just infects our entire industry. People showing photos of what their turf grass looks like after some product was applied. Okay. It's a very slippery slope to go down those roads to where you start believing this stuff. Don't do it. Okay. I can recreate this in 5 minutes. It's not difficult. Not saying their product didn't do it. I'm just saying that I'm not convinced that it did do it because I haven't seen anything convincing or anything compelling that would convince me that it actually did it.
This picture was taken on June 16th. 6 weeks earlier, both of these lawns were treated with the same granular fertilizer at the same rate. As you can see, the lawn on the left is holding better color and density. It was treated with 2 spring applications of Armament Concentrate at 16 ounces per acre. The lawn on the right is starting to decline and lose color. Armament is improving the availability of multiple nutrients, which results in better, longer-lasting color and healthier plants.
So this is epistemology. What's the question we should ask? If he was here or if he was in front of you selling you the product, what's the question that you should ask? He said Armament technology is providing more soluble nutrients and healthier plants. What's the question? How do you know? That's epistemology. How do you know? Because all I'm looking at is a photograph with kind of halfway looking better looking green on the left, like you said, and a little less green grass on the right. That doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, even if I was the one that went out and put this out, it wouldn't mean anything to me. I need a lot more information than just the grass looks greener because I put a product out, if in fact it even did that, before I'm convinced that this Armament potassium acetate is the actual causal agent in the product. There's a lot of things in these products, and to identify the actual ingredient that's causing it is, you know, it takes more than a photograph. I'll say that. Let's continue.
And here's a very similar scenario. The entire lawn was treated with 30-00 at a rate of 0.35 pounds of N per 1,000. To the left of this red line, no Armament was tank mixed. To the right, Armament Concentrate was tank mixed with a 30-00 at a rate of 32 ounces per acre.
Yeah, so for those who are listening, the one on the right is a little darker green than the one on the left, and they're underneath some trees here. Looks like probably some cool season grass.
So 5 weeks later, you can see the difference. The area that didn't receive Armament Concentrate is really starting to lose color. Density. This side, the area of the lawn that was treated with Armament Concentrate, is really maintaining color and positive health. Again, this turf is seeing a better balance of nutrition with the addition of Armament Concentrate.
So a better balance of nutrition. How do you know? I mean, it sounds like I'm being picky, but I mean, how do you know that? How do you know it's getting a better balance of nutrition? Maybe there was more nitrogen in it. Maybe there was more iron in it. Maybe there was something else in it that caused it. Maybe you could apply an element to the left side equal to the right side and see the same response, and it's not the actual component of Armament. Maybe it's something else. I haven't seen anything other than some photographs. And that doesn't convince me. And I hope that at this point, after how long we've been doing this, 6 months or so, I hope we're starting to gain a little bit of critical thinking into this process. So when you see this stuff, you can immediately start pulling out the flaws. Some photograph doesn't mean anything to me. That's just marketing nonsense. I'm not saying that his product didn't do it. I'm not here to say the product did not do this. I'm here to say that I'm not convinced that it did do it. Because there's no good reason. There's no evidence to support that it did do it. So don't believe that it did do it. There's no reason to spend money on it. I haven't seen any good reason to spend any money on this yet at all. So that's sort of where I'm going with all this.
We also see great results from granular fertilizers that have been impregnated with armament technology.
Yeah, so now they're showing a Twitter. This is what they love, man. Marketing people love people who put stuff on Twitter and tag the company name or the product name and show a photo and look how green this is. Look how long my roots are and all these things. They love that stuff because it's a little bit of a bandwagon sort of mentality, a little bit of a historical fallacy. Like, you know, this is what we did. This is what everybody else is doing. And look how good it is. It's nonsense, guys. Come on. Keep going.
This homeowner called his lawn care operator and insisted they come and see his lawn because the color was so green. This was a few weeks after an application of a 22-311 granular fertilizer with armament. This is great results and another great way to apply armament technology.
Yeah, so what would have happened if you applied a 23-311 without it? You know, what if you randomized it and did nothing in 23-311 and 23-311 with armament? What if there's something in the armament that you're not accounting for as an elemental or as a nutrient component that you're not accounting for? You know, what if there's, like I said, iron or nitrogen or something else, and who knows what? You know, I'm just saying there's a lot of other things in it, in these products, than you usually just the technology or just some element or whatever. There's usually other things in it that are not balanced out properly. And if they're not balanced out properly, you can't tell. And I've said the same thing about even articles, scientific articles. I mentioned it yesterday morning when there was a very good article published and they were looking at potassium responses. They used potassium sulfate. And I mentioned in this particular case, we're not going to be able to be absolutely confident that was from the potassium because it came along with sulfate and sulfate is often deficient. So the same thing holds true for this. You know, my criticism holds true on both ends, right? Whether it's in the scientific realm or in the marketing realm, it's the same logic. Let's continue.
Well, I hope you see by now that armament technology should be a big part of any turfgrass management program, whether it's a lawn care, athletic fields, or golf course. It's versatile. It fits into granular or liquid programs.
Actually, I can just stop it there because he just repeats it. It just summarizes everything. So here's my take on the product, if you haven't got it already. The product might work. The product might actually do all the magical stuff it says it'll do. Some sort of product that has a long carbon chain on it that results in elements becoming more soluble in the soil. Either with fertilizer you're applying, it keeps those nutrients more soluble, I think is what they're saying, and more, I think they say available. It maintains the solubility of elements in the soil compared to if it's not applied with the armament and so forth. All that may be absolutely true, but I have zero reason to believe that it is true. And until I have a good reason to believe that it is true, I'm going to keep my money in my pocket. And I hope you do too. So even if you see a photograph, even if 15 guys down the road say, yeah, I'm using it and it works great, even if it's been on the market for 3-4 years and everybody says it's great, all of those are really bad reasons. If you want me to, I'll go through all the logic behind it and the rationale behind why those are bad reasons if you want me to. But those are all bad reasons. What are good reasons is evidence published in a refereed reputable turfgrass journal. Once you hit that, then you start moving up the pyramid from the bottom of that pyramid of evidence, from all the noise and all the opinions and all the gossip and all the nonsense that exists down at the bottom. and you move up a rung or two. When you move up a rung or two, that's when I start paying attention. And you can't move up a rung or two until you get published. So that's what guards my guards me. So that's my take on that product. I have no idea if it works or doesn't work. And I'm sure you're in the same boat. If you're listening or you're watching this, you probably have no idea if it works or doesn't work. But whether it works or doesn't work is irrelevant to me. I saw no evidence to indicate that it would work, so I have no reason to buy it. Okay, that's my take. Okay, let's close that out. Unless there's a question or two. Sydney Whitaker, watching from South Alabama. It's a little bit sort of where I, in the general area where I used to live, kind of. I was lived in North Florida there for about 16 years. And welcome, Jesse B., back. John Lobenstein. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Lobenstein. First time listening live. Thanks for your contributions to turf-related truth. You're welcome. Thanks for coming. Thanks for watching. John Federer says, so much of the turfgrass marketing is just FOMO. If you don't use armament, you're not part of their crowd. Yeah. This company actually has a really good video on soil testing that I will go over when I get to it. The video is 45 minutes long, so I'm going to have to break it up into many episodes. But it is absolute pure gold when it comes to the content I'm looking for this channel. So we will go over that when we get to soil testing, whenever that is. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to go to the PowerPoint, and I want to start this off by, let me go to this. I want to start this off, power, here we go, right here. Okay. I want to start this off by saying this would be, I thought I had this already made. I have several potassium presentations already made, but I thought I had one kind of ready to go. And I do, but it wasn't really what I wanted for this channel. So I spent some time today kind of refining it and getting this a little bit more like I would like for it to be. But there's a lot of data on this presentation, a lot of graphs and so forth. But the point of this presentation is to set the stage for the remainder of the month about potassium and turf grass. And this is the title of this is Applied Potassium and Turf Grass Stress. So the title of this video, and if you listen to a podcast, is called Potassium is Stressful. And the reason I wanted to use that title is that a lot of people, and I don't know where, maybe it's marketing, you know, I don't know where, but a lot of people have this misconception in the industry of that potassium is the stress element. It's the all-around element. I've seen this in a number of videos. And there are clear cases where the application of potassium can help reduce the risk of, say, winter kill stress, winter low-temperature tolerant stress and things like that. There's a little bit with diseases here and there where there's a little bit of a benefit in some cases with diseases. But there are many, many examples in the literature of potassium being associated with increasing stress. So this presentation is intended to be given to an audience that already presupposes that potassium will help with your stress, help with the turf grass stress. So in here, you're going to see a lot of examples of potassium actually resulting in the opposite effect. Okay. I don't know how many examples I have in here where potassium results in a negative effect. And there are a couple examples where I show some potassium resulting in a positive effect, say on winter kill or on anthracnose, for example. So there may be occasions where you may ask yourself, well, all you're showing is all the stuff where it doesn't work. That's the point of this presentation. Is if you're under the impression that potassium is either benign to the turf grass itself or will help one of those two, then you're You're flawed. You're incorrect. Potassium is oftentimes benign. It oftentimes will not do anything at all for the turf. Occasionally, it will help in very specific situations, but also it can harm the turf. The health of the turf can be harmed greatly as a result of excess applications of potassium. And I'm going to show examples on diseases, examples on warm season grasses, on cool season grasses. I'm going to show many examples where nothing happened when it comes to drought tolerance and things like that. Okay, when it comes to roots, nothing happens and so forth. Okay, but that's the point. Keep in mind, I understand there's a literature that shows some positive effects. I get that. There are some there, and we'll get there this month. But this presentation is intended to debunk this idea that potassium can only either be beneficial or benign, because that's not the case. It can also be harmful to your turf grass. Okay, let's see if I can get this on here. Oh, I did. First shot. Look at that. Okay. So, this is a publication that Dr. Munch and I published a long time ago in here in Kentucky, and I wish other states had this, but we have a soil testing lab here in Kentucky that's fantastic, and they keep a database of soil tests, and they have it identified by county and dates and all these things. And I put on here a map that has the state of Kentucky by counties, and it's a colored map. As the counties are colored differently, and they're colored based upon the probability of actually growing grass in a soil that is low enough in potassium that you would probably see a response to applying potassium. So these sort of beige looking counties are a 0% probability. So what that means is that at the University of Kentucky soil testing facility, they've never actually received a soil test from a turf grass location that was low enough to warrant the application of potassium in the last 20, well, it's since 94 or 5, I think it was, so almost 30 years. They've never received a sample. And I'm here in Fayette County let me get back on the screen, on this little northeast, north central area here of Kentucky. Look, there's probably 15, 20 counties here that they've never got a single sample that ever would have resulted in a response to applying potassium. Okay. The best case scenario is there's about a 10% probability you might grow grass on a soil that's 40, 50 parts per million, maybe 3 or less. It's about a 10% chance in one county. That's it. In other words, in the whole state of Kentucky, the best case scenario is you have about a 10% chance of growing grass on a soil low in K. Reality is, you probably will never encounter that. The other however many counties there are in Kentucky, you're not going to see, you're not really ever going to encounter a soil with low enough potassium that you would actually see a response to applying potassium to turf grass. Not going to happen. So go check out that publication if you're interested. I have some other publications on phosphorus and things like that that are similar to this. But this is showing this to indicate that potassium is not that deficient in Kentucky, at least. Other states it is. There's areas of Florida that it can be deficient, right? Because it's very sandy. But in Kentucky and other states that have decent soils, you have very little chance of ever seeing a benefit to applying potassium. Potassium in the plant, it's the second greatest mineral nutrient behind nitrogen. There's no role in structure of potassium. It's the only element that never enters into an organic compound. It's used for osmoregulation, water movement, and so forth, and enzyme activation. So it floats around in the plant. It never really enters any structural areas, or it helps move water and it helps activation of enzymes and things like that. The claimed benefits are it increases rooting. If you've ever heard of a benefit or a claim of potassium that's not on this list, be quick in the chat because there's a 15-second delay. Put it in chat and I'll mention it on the verbally. I'll mention it, but the claims are it increases rooting. Potassium can increase drought resistance. It can act as a winterizer. It can increase wear tolerance. I heard that a lot, and it can reduce disease occurrence. I've heard that a lot. Okay. There's probably some other ones in here, but These are some very common claims of potassium fertilization to turf grass. And we're going to go over every one of these in this order. Okay. We're going to show evidence on all of this stuff. Rooting, right off the beginning. So rooting was the first one right here. Increases rooting. So I've heard potassium increases rooting. If anybody watched the, what was it, Wednesday morning show, we had some rooting information on there. We're going to go over some more rooting right now. Rooting. So here's a, we're looking at a bar chart here from Crop Science. And this is the rooting depth of perennial ryegrass as influenced by potassium. And we're looking at 1 pound of K per year, 5 pounds of K per year, or 9 pounds of K per year. And we're looking at the top 4 inches and then like 4 to 10 inches and then like 10 to 20 inches in depth. So we're looking at the depth, we're separating out the different depths of the soil. They sampled the roots and they partitioned it at depths. And we're going to see what happens to the rooting at depths of perennial ryegrass is influenced by K. And any bar under the same line is the same statistically or statistically similar. So any of these bars that's under the same red line under 0 to 10 or 0 to 4 inches are all the same. So 1, 5, and 9 pounds a year of K per year, none of them influenced, none of those rates of K influenced rooting at any of the depths. So potassium did not influence rooting of perennial ryegrass in this particular study. I believe this was a 5-year study, if I recall. Even so, you could buy all that potassium if you want to and put it all out if you want to, but it's not going to do anything to the roots in that in this particular case. Let's go to the next graph. So here's something very similar. We're looking at potassium rates on the x-axis. This is from Crop Science in 2002. It's the effect of potassium on roots of Tifway Bermuda grass. So that was the previous one was a cool season grass. Now let's look at Bermuda grass. We're going from 0 pounds of K every 3 months, and we have 6 or 7 potassium levels all the way up to 7.5 pounds of potassium every 3 months. This was actually conducted at my old research center in North Florida when I was a student. And this was actually going on when I was a student. This was conducted by my professor, and as graduate students, we went out and actually conducted some of this work for him. And we see various rates of potassium on the x-axis and then root dry weight on the y-axis. And we see that all these bars from 0 pounds of K all the way to 7.5 pounds of K every 30 days, or every 3 months, are all the same when it comes to roots. And this is in North Florida, on a sandy Arredondo fine sand that is low in K usually. I can't remember I'm going to go over this article. I can't remember what the K was in this particular state. I want to say it was low, like 30 parts per million or less. I can't remember. But it was fairly low in K, low in nutrient retention. They applied 0 K. They applied 3/4 pound, 1.5 pounds, 2 pounds, 3 pounds, 4.5 pounds, 6 pounds, and 7.5 pounds of K every 3 months to Tifway Bermuda grass. And absolutely nothing happened to the roots. So, before we go to drought tolerance, the claim that potassium will influence roots, you might find some evidence in the literature, maybe. I'm not saying you won't. I'm simply showing that to say that there's very clear evidence in the literature that indicates that it does not influence roots, or at least the scenario can exist where applying potassium, even on sandy soils, even on low K soils, will not influence root mass. Okay? Cool season grasses or warm season grasses. I'm not here saying it'll never do it. I'm just saying there's evidence to indicate that it won't do it. So, you know, understand what I'm saying. I'm not claiming that it will never influence it, but my confidence is directly proportional to the evidence, and the evidence is pretty strong that it won't influence potassium. The application of potassium will not influence roots of turf grass. So let's look at drought tolerance. There's not a whole lot here on drought tolerance. Even the Frank Gertal review paper only had a handful of papers in there, and they weren't very, papers in there weren't particularly compelling. It was they showed a little bit more of like drought resistant mechanisms per se. They didn't really actually show like the turf quality in times of drought and things like that. But let's look at drought. There are a couple papers on drought tolerance. In on warm season grasses. This was for warm season grasses. Some people had asked to go over warm season grasses, and I'll go over this paper. This paper was conducted at my old research center again, and this was in Fort Lauderdale. This was conducted on Tiff Eagle, Tiff Dwarf, Sea Dwarf Paspalum, and Zoysia grass, Pristine Flora Zoysia grass. They had three drought levels, and they used four different NDK ratios, a 1:1, a 1:2, 1:3, 1:4. So they applied nitrogen, they applied increasing levels of potassium. And John Rowland, this was by Cesar and Snyder, this was published in Agronomy Journal in 2014. And they concluded that increasing potassium did not increase quality, did not increase drought tolerance, which is why we're here on this slide, did not increase NDVI, for those of you who don't know, is the natural green reflectance of turf, and it did not influence the chlorophyll index. So in this particular paper, drought tolerance was not affected by the application of potassium. Increasing potassium did not increase the drought tolerance of these putting green grasses on sandy putting greens. And I know that particular putting green. I was there. I maintained that thing for 3 or 4 years. I mean, it's a USGA spec green. High sand, low nutrient retention, hot, 365 days of growing. And they're applying all this potassium down there to see if it had an effect on drought tolerance. And there was no effect on drought tolerance at three different levels of drought tolerance. I remember he had those little irrigation heads all in that green for those different levels of drought tolerance. There's a lot of work they did. So the most beneficial results occurred when K was deficient. Rarely has a benefit to applied K been documented when the turf grass was already supplied with sufficient K. And the turf grass is often already supplied with sufficient K. That's why I showed that map at the beginning of the presentation from Kentucky. We don't have that for every state. But for the state of Kentucky, the chances of you growing grass in deficient, at least on native soils, with deficient potassium is pretty low. You have almost no chance of growing grass on a native Kentucky soil that would be low in potassium. Like I said, even in putting greens, the benefit of applying K oftentimes is small. Okay. Now, as a winterizer, now if there's one thing in the lawn care industry, and even in golf and in sport turf, that really permeates the idea of, you know, fall fertility, is it's fall fertility of potassium as a winterizer. This actually is the one area, although I would argue it's relatively weak, but this is the one area that there is some evidence supporting this concept, this claim. Let's talk about it. Adam Moeller, he was at Rutgers, and he took a photograph and posted it on Twitter of some poa plots there. And he says, with less than 50 parts per million soil, this was Malic 3 soil potassium, much more damage from freeze injury compared to those with higher K soils. So I'm showing a photograph of some brown-looking poa putting greens. And in this square here, he's saying that this square here was less than 50 parts per million, and it was susceptible to freeze injury, whereas the plots around it, had higher potassium levels, and they're obviously much more green on the photograph. Here's a larger photograph from his publication, the Schmidt et al. 2000. Oh, I didn't put it down here. This is a Schmidt paper from Applied Turf Grass, where annual bluegrass winter kill when soil K is less than 28 parts per million in New Jersey. And you see this dead grass, well, looking deadish looking turf grass from Poa annua. You can see all these little squares on this rectangles on this plot up here, where these all did not receive potassium. And they were susceptible to winter kill, and the turf grass around it received potassium, and they did not succumb to winter kill. Okay, great. That grass was able to survive. The grass that did not receive the K died. And here you see a photograph also in that same publication he published years ago, where we see no K, and we see some plugs on a greenhouse tray, where most of this grass here on the left with no potassium is dead. And then you see the two columns here with plus potassium. You see the photograph of the grass there where they are much more green. And these are greenhouse trays that, if I'm not mistaken, he actually artificially froze or put snow on top of. I can't remember exactly how he did it, but But you can see the benefit to applying K when the winter kill can occur. Now, this is the same study. When I get through with this study, I'm gonna take a second to explain exactly a little bit more here. So now we're looking at a bar chart with winter kill of annual bluegrass influence by applied K. So this is the actual data from the Schmidt 2016 study. So on the x-axis, we're looking at non-treated turf grass, and we have potassium chloride at various rates of potassium. We have potassium sulfate at various rates of potassium. And we're looking at what's going to happen in the middle of March, the middle of April, and the middle of May, okay? And turf injury from winter kills on the left on the y-axis. And we see that in March, the non-treated turf was about 60% dead, whereas turf grass treated at any level of potassium with any source of potassium resulted in about 2 or 3% death, turf injury, basically. So it went from 60% turf injury down to about 2 or 3% turf injury with any level of potassium, starting at 1.3 pounds of potassium per year, going up to 5.4 pounds of potassium per year. In April, there was no death at all when potassium was applied, or turf injury when potassium was applied, but there was about 30% turf injury when potassium was not applied. And when in May, there was about 10% turf injury when potassium was not applied, and there was no turf injury when potassium was applied from any source at any rate. So this is pretty convincing evidence that when the soil is low in K, that the application of K can be beneficial in terms of reducing their risk of winter kill. But let's keep this in mind. Let's make sure this is all clear, is that it was only when the turf grass was low, and he said it was 28 parts per million, I believe it was, 29 parts per million when the death occurred. And the alleviation of that risk, that stress, was found at the lowest rate of K, just 1.3 pounds per year, and it dropped it from 60% turf injury down to 1 or 2. Okay. So there's a couple key points here. Is one, the conditions had to be right. It had to be just right for winter kill. Okay. And it had to be right for low soil K. So if winter kill is going to occur, what these data are saying is that if winter kill is going to occur, it's going to occur more likely when the soil K is low. And if that's the case, you don't need to go out at these exorbitant high rates of potassium. They found the reduction occurred just by simply applying 1.3 pounds of K per year. Just a little bit. Not 5 pounds and 7 pounds and 10 pounds. They didn't need to apply those. So all of this was waste. All this 2.7 and 5.4 was all waste. They didn't need to apply those high rates. Just apply a little bit. Well, they needed to figure it out, but you don't need to apply those high rates. Just apply a little bit of potassium if the soil potassium is low, and if you're in a situation where the turf grass might succumb to winter kill, then you might see a benefit to applying potassium. Okay? The lethal temperatures for perennial ryegrass influenced by applied K. Now, in this case, Webster and Eben in 2005 were looking at 1, 5, and 9 pounds of K applied to perennial ryegrass, and they're looking at the lethal temperature. So the idea is that will applying potassium reduce the lethal temperature? In other words, let's say the turf grass died at say 25 degrees Fahrenheit or something. Well, if applying K reduced it down to 23 or 22 degrees Fahrenheit, that might save a lot of acres of turf grass, even a 1 or 2 degree reduction, right? So they were looking at this lethal temperature, and we found that in late winter or in early spring, the application of 1, 5, or 9 pounds of K didn't do anything in terms of reducing the lethal temperature for perennial ryegrass. 1 pound of K, 5 pounds of K, and 9 pounds of K were all the same in terms of the lethal temperature in this late winter, and they were all the same in terms of lethal temperature in early spring. Okay? So in this case, it didn't have an effect on lethal temperature. In the prior case, it did have an effect on surviving winter kill for Poania. So it can occur, right? Okay, so this idea of winterizer is not completely unfounded, There is some evidence there, but the idea of going out with winterizers across every single location and all the lawns and all the sport turf and all the golf course fairways and roughs and greens and tees and everywhere, just because you want the word winterizers on the bag or whatever, that's not a BMP. Now, I understand the logistical challenges of going, you can't do something different on every single lawn. I get that if you're a lawn care operator. But you got to look at the bulk of your lawns. You got to find some way to look at this and say, well, is the tail wagging the dog here? Or is it a legitimate issue with the majority of my customers? Right? Because if your soil K is, well, according to this study, 50 parts per million or greater, Malic 3, applying more K, even if it is going to kill the grass, even if the temperature is going to kill the grass, applying more K is probably not going to help. Okay. If it's lower than that, if it's down in the 30s and 20s, it still won't help unless winter kill is going to occur. Of course, you can't predict that. But if it's down that low, at least you have an evidence-based reason to potentially include that potassium application in the fall, just in case winter kill is going to occur. If it's going to occur, then you have low K, then you have a good reason. Okay. But if winter kill is going to occur and the soil K is already there, applying more isn't going to help. And that's what those slides said, whether it was, you know, a little bit of K or a lot of K, that's what the Schmidt paper just found. Let me back up to that and I'll make sure we're clear. That's what these data are saying right here. It doesn't, if winter kill is going to occur, you don't need to go out there and throw out all this large amounts of potassium, just a little bit. That's all you got to do. Okay. Applying more and more and more ain't going to help. Okay, let's go to wear tolerance now. This is one that I like the most for some reason. I don't know why I like wear tolerance with potassium, because it's really one of the most bizarre claims. It's just strange. I don't know. And I don't know if it's a scientist's fault, if it's our fault, or if it's the marketer's fault. I don't know whose fault it is, but where this idea came from that potassium is going to help wear tolerance, I don't know. Maybe there's something in the literature from way back when. I have no clue. But we're going to go into wear tolerance. We're going to spend quite a bit of time here on wear tolerance here. So let's check this out. So this is for a lot of the golfers and the sport turf people when it comes to wear tolerance. We want to go out there and throw out all this potassium to reduce the wear and tear on the turf grass. Well, let's look and see what the actual evidence says. Wear tolerance. So wear tolerance versus wear recovery, I'm going to define both of these. Wear tolerance is the ability of turf grass to resist physical damage from golf carts, from cleats, from baseball, from football, whatever, from horses, whatever the case is, people walking on it. It's the ability to resist the damage. Wear recovery is the ability to reestablish after the damage has occurred. So I'm going to keep that in mind as we go through some of these data. The hypothesized potassium mechanism on wear tolerance is that it might result in greater turgidity of the leaf, which is the stiffness of the leaf, might reduce tissue succulence, which would, you know, in other words, the soft tissues, it might reduce those soft tissues. It might increase the cell wall rigidity, the stiffness of the leaf as well, the actual cell wall itself, and it might have an influence on stomatal control, which might have an influence on wear tolerance. That's the hypothesized mechanism behind wear tolerance. Let's see what the actual evidence says. So now we're looking at seashore pads, palum cell wall concentrations influenced by applied potassium. Remember that what I just said in prior to the previous slide is cell wall rigidity. Okay, so, you know, that this is the idea that somehow it's going to influence the cell wall. So, well, Lori Trinholm back in 2001, I think at the time this was her work when she was in Georgia, did some work on seashore pass palum cell wall concentrations as influenced by applied K. She applied 2 pounds of K or 8 pounds of K, and she measured in the actual cells themselves, the lignocellulose, the lignin, the hemicellulose, or the cellulose. This is all on the x-axis for those listening. And then on the right axis, we're going to have grams per kilogram of the various constituents of the cell. And we're going to look at 2 pounds versus 8 pounds. And we find that all these bars are under the same line, or within each component with like lignocellulose, where there was 2 or 8 pounds, it was the same amount of lignocellulose. Where there was 2 or 8 pounds of K, it was the same amount of lignin. It was the same amount of hemicellulose and the same amount of cellulose in the cell wall. So applying 2 pounds of K or 8 pounds of K didn't change the cell wall concentrations of these various cell components. So this doesn't support that hypothesis. Let's look what happens with perennial ryegrass. So the effect of potassium on the cell wall components of a cool season grass. We just did a warm season grass, which was Seashore Paspalum. Now we're going to do a cool season grass. Now we're going to look at 1, 5, and 9 pounds of potassium. We're going to look at the total cell wall components, the lignocellulose, and the hemicellulose on this study by Hoffman in 2010. Now on the y-axis, we have the percent of the cell that contains lignocellulose. And we find, again, there was actually a There is actually a reduction in some of the cell wall components as potassium goes up. So at 1 pound a K, the percent of the total cell wall was 70, let's say 70. And when you go up to 5 pounds and 9 pounds, the total cell wall was declined. It probably is not biological, but it declined to about 68 or 69. Statistically, there was a reduction when the potassium went up. When you look at lignocellulose, there was also a statistical reduction when you went from 5 pounds of K to 9 pounds of K. Again, I don't think that's biologically significant, but statistically that showed the reduction as you added more K. There was a reduction in lignocellulose in the cell wall, the one thing that's supposed to be going up. Hemicellulose, there was no difference in the cell wall. So whether it was warm season grass, Seashore Paspalum, or cool season grass, there's no evidence, I didn't show any evidence here, that would support this idea that you're going to have more cell wall hemicellulose or more cell wall lignocellulose in the cell which would in turn somehow result in a resistance or tolerance of wear, okay? Resist wear tolerance or wear damage, sorry. We're actually seeing a reduction, if anything, not an increase. Let's look at the percent unworn turf following wear, influenced by applied potassium. This was by Carol and Petrovic in 1991. We're going to look at 0 pounds of K, 1 pound of K, 2 pounds of K, and 4 pounds of K at three different grasses on the x-axis, Kentucky bluegrass and two types of creeping bentgrass. And on the left axis, we're looking at unworn turf. Okay. So when we see this, we go from 0 pounds of K all the way to 4 pounds of K with Kentucky bluegrass, we see no difference in the unworn turf based upon potassium. We don't see any difference in the unworn turf when we go from 0 pounds of K to 4 pounds of K from the Kentucky blue or from the creeping bentgrass variety 1 or the creeping bentgrass variety 2. There was no benefit in terms of reducing the unworn turf or the wear tolerance of these turf grasses by applying potassium. In this particular study, there was 0 pounds of K applied. We applied all the way up to 4 pounds and there was no benefit. Didn't reduce wear tolerance. Perennial ryegrass wear tolerance, this was by Hoffman in 2010. You're going to see a lot of his work. He did 1, 5, and 9 pounds of K. Hang on 1 second. Let me look at this question. Chuck, you're asking, well, yeah, you don't have to apologize for asking. You can always ask a question. What is the result of 0 pounds of K applied in the prior two graphs? The result of 0 pounds of K? Talking about this graph right here, what is the result? This is that would just be the control. So that's the turf grass where, I don't know what you mean by the result, but I mean, that's the turf where no potassium was applied at all. If potassium is going to result in a benefit to wear tolerance, you're going to see these bar graphs go up. As potassium goes up, you're going to see more unworn turf under higher rates of potassium. But when you have zero potassium, that's just if you didn't apply any. I'm sorry, I didn't fully understand your question, Chuck. If I missed it, then ask again. I'll be a little more specific and I'll try to answer your question. So perennial ryegrass wear tolerance, we're looking at relative chlorophyll index days after treatment. And the chlorophyll index is oftentimes used in terms of wear because you'll see the grass change color as it gets worn in. And so the relative chlorophyll index, 1, 5, and 9 pounds of K, and we're going to be looking at 2, 5, 7, and 14 days after application. And I'm starting to sound like a broken record, but whether you applied 1 pound or 9 pounds, and whether you measured at 2, 5, 7, or 14 days after application, there was no change in the relative chlorophyll index. The relative chlorophyll index was the same across all potassium levels. So you didn't need to apply 5 and 9 pounds. You might probably didn't need to apply 1 pound. They didn't have a zero control in the study, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a zero here, it'd be the same. Let's look at year two, the exact same study, but in year two, relative chlorophyll index, perennial ryegrass, and in year two, 1, 5, and 9 pounds a K. And we do see a slight change in the first 2 days after treatment, but it declined with 5 pounds a K. So the 1 pound a K, the relative chlorophyll index is about 80. And when you applied 5 pounds a K, the relative chlorophyll index went down to about 70. It's not supposed to go down. It's supposed to go up. If potassium is actually having a beneficial impact on wear tolerance, the chlorophyll index, there would be more green grass is what it's saying. But there wasn't more green grass. There was less green grass with more potassium. And then 5, 7, and 14 days after application, there were no differences among potassium treatments. Okay. Oh, okay. Check. Now I understand. Yeah. His question is, or for clarification, he's asking, why do they not contain zero pounds a K? Why do some studies not contain zero? There's a variety of answers for that. I don't know. Oftentimes, they don't have enough space. They have to start choosing treatments because they don't have enough actual space to actually put any treatment they want. That's sometimes a reason. Other times, they would argue that, or I would argue that the zero is not biologically relevant. So, for example, with nitrogen, sometimes we won't include a zero because if you like, let's say on some plants, you would never include a zero nitrogen treatment because the plant might die. Like, it's not biologically relevant to our society. We're going to be applying some nitrogen. So in some cases that might be the case. So I don't really know why the authors didn't include zero in all these studies, but it happens sometimes. I would prefer they do, because even if the plant did die, it's science. It might not necessarily be pragmatic, but we would still be able to compare it to what would occur in the absence of that element. So it's a good, you know, valid question, Chuck. Perennial ryegrass, rare recovery. Now we're looking at the recovery after damage. Okay. After damage. The damage has been done. Now we apply 1, 5, and 9 pounds a K, and there's no difference. 2, 4, 8, 12, and 16 weeks after treatment, the turf was worn down in Massachusetts, perennial ryegrass. The turf was worn. They start applying potassium to see how fast it would recover after the damage already occurred. And 1, 5, and 9 pounds, there was no benefit in terms of of increasing wear recovery in year one. We go to year two, and there was a little bit of a benefit at the second week when we applied 1 pound. We saw about a rating of about 4.8, and we applied 5 pounds. We saw it increase to about 5.2, 5.3, very small increase, but statistically there was an increase when you applied 5 pounds a K. You got a tiny bit increase in terms of where the wear rating increased a little bit. And then 4, 8, 12, and 16 weeks, there was nothing. Nothing happened. So Hoffman 2010 summarized it and said potassium and the nitrogen times potassium interaction had little to no effect on wear tolerance and recovery, possibly owing to adequate levels of soil available potassium at the treatment site. And the soil K at that location was a Morgan extract at 119 parts per million. Okay, so at that location, the potassium was probably sufficient. They didn't need to apply more. Applying more was a waste of time and a waste of money. And we're about to see potentially an increase in risk in other areas. Okay, right now, a lot of that was simply saying, showing what I'm showing is, nothing happened. You know, what was the effect on rooting? Nothing happened. What was the effect on drought recovery? Nothing happened, right? On wear tolerance, nothing happened. So nothing's really happening, good or bad. But when you're applying copious amounts of potassium, particularly when the soil is already loaded with potassium, there can be potential harmful consequences, which is what we're about to go into. Okay, got one more before I go into it. Under aerification recovery, this is a study we've already gone over, ladies and gentlemen. You may not remember it, but we've gone over this paper before. It's the Caro 87 paper, which is a ridiculously awesome paper. Love that paper. He shows things so clearly in that paper. And we're showing turf density following aerification. So we're recovering from damage. And we see that the application of potassium at 1 pound, 2 pounds, and 4 pounds of potassium, we actually see a reduction in density the higher up we go. So the 1 pound of K, you see the turf density is 9.5 in August. It's 9 if when you apply 4 pounds of K, and it's about 8.8, 8.7 when you apply 2 pounds of K. Statistically significant and biologically significant. You see a reduction in recovery from damage when you apply more K in 1983. You see the same thing in 1984, where you see a reduction. This is 1 pound, and then you apply the 2 and 4 pounds, and you see a reduction of recovery. Okay. So Bob Carroll found the same thing in 1987, guys. For potassium to enhance wear tolerance or recovery, it is likely that potassium would need to increase cell wall constituents, or its deficiency result in a secondary effect, i.e. disease or drought. And we just don't see that. I mean, not the first part. We don't see the part where it's influencing the cell wall constituents. Okay. Yeah, Sydney Whitaker, you ask a really good question. And I'm just going to say, I'm going to reserve that for a paper I'm going to go over in a couple more days. It's not entirely clear. And I know a lot of people will jump on that bandwagon and say, the question is this, guys, for those listening. Sydney Whitaker asks in chat, with Centipede, is MOP or muriate of potash, KCL, harmful? I've heard that you should stick to sulfate of potash. What are my thoughts on that? My thoughts on that are applying SOP. The difference between MOP and SOP, one's KCL and one's potassium sulfate. One has the chloride ion, one has the sulfate ion. If you want to err on the side of safety, then just go to SOP. Having said that, KCL is usually not a problem. You're asking specifically to Centipede, and I think I have an article on that question. I'm pretty sure I have an article on Centipede potassium. I can't remember it off the top of my head. But the reason I say SOP, if you just want to be safe, is not just because of the lower burn potential, but also because it contains sulfate in an environment, i.e. our time frame right now, 2020s, that is continuing to show responses to sulfate. Turfgrass responses to sulfate are becoming more and more common. So I'm going to show it at the end of the presentation. If you see a response to potassium sulfate in centipede grass and you say, oh, well, I need to use potassium sulfate instead of potassium chloride, that can often be also a post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. You can say, okay, oh, I applied SOP and I saw a response. It must have been the KCL. That's probably what was causing the problem. No, what was probably causing the problem is that you applied sulfate. And it had nothing to do with the difference between KCL and SOP as a salt or as a burn potential. It had to do with you're just simply applying sulfate. You would have seen the same response from gypsum. You would have seen the same response from magnesium sulfate or manganese sulfate. Okay. So you want to be careful with these old wives' tales about, well, Centipede, you need to use SOP instead of MOP. I'm not saying that's not the case. I'm not saying the MOP is worse or SOP is better. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't do that. I haven't answered the question yet. I'm just saying that the benefit of SOP is not just in its burn potential reduction. It's also in the ability of it to supply a macronutrient that is commonly deficient nowadays, and that's sulfate. Okay. But I'll answer that question more clearly and probably next week, if not then the week after. I just can't remember that article off the top of my head, and I don't want to say anything that conflicts with the evidence in that article. Excellent question. I'm sorry I couldn't answer it any better. So let's go to disease. The one area that I know almost nothing about. Diseases. Potassium for diseases. Dr. Soldat has done a lot of work on this, and I feel bad. I've already asked him to come on the show twice, and he was gracious enough to come on twice. And now I'm getting into all the stuff he's really good at, and I'm hesitant to ask him to come back on because I'm afraid I'm going to, wear him out. But we're looking at a photo from Dr. Soldat in 2003. In the middle square, we have the application of potassium, which is pound and three quarters, I guess, almost a pound and three quarters of potassium per year. And we see some microdocium in the middle of this plot, as opposed to no potassium on the right and the left. And there's very little microdocium in that plot. And so he's seeing that up in, this is on bent grass. He's seeing that up in his area on bent grass. The application of potassium is increasing this disease. We're going to show some data on this for the first time on the channel, I think. K rate appears to be less influential, according to Dr. Soldat. He's saying basically if you're applying K, you got a problem. If you apply more and more and more K, he's not really seeing a whole lot of, there is an increase, but it's not as significant as the reality of just applying any K. He has no K here on the bottom, and we see little disease. He has 1 pound, 2 pounds, and 6 pounds of K, and we see about the same amount of disease in all these plots. Okay, he has gypsum down here as a secondary check as well, and we don't see much disease in that either. So the salt is not a problem. It's the actual something going on with the potassium. So this here is calcium sulfate, and these up here, I believe, are potassium sulfate, and we see the disease is only in the potassium sulfate plots. Not only, but primarily in the potassium sulfate plots. So now let's look at actually some hard data. He published this his student published this in 2018. And we're looking at a bar chart here of the microdocium patch percent area affected on bent grass. And we're looking in March, April of 2016, and then February 2017. And we're looking at about, I'm just going to ballpark these numbers, a little bit less than a pound of K, a little bit less than 2 pounds of K, and then about 5 pounds of K, I guess is what that is, 5 pounds of K, something like that. And we're looking at a control. And you see here that these over here in February 2017, where you're looking at 50, 60% of the plot area is affected by microdocium compared to the control at about 20. Okay. You see a similar issue here in April of 2016, where you're looking at about a 20 to 25% area affected by the on the potassium plots, whereas with the control you're looking at less than 5% affected. The same thing in March 2015, it's just a little bit lower, looking at 10 to 15% of the area affected by potassium plots, and about 2 or 3% affected by the control. So it's pretty clear here, guys and gals. You're applying potassium, you're increasing your risk of some diseases on some grasses. And I've been saying that for weeks, and here's right and staring you in the face. You can go look it up. Beer et al. 2018. I think this was in Geoderma, if I remember correctly. Okay. That's about as clear as you're going to get. But if that doesn't convince you, I got more. Okay. Dr. Woods did some work in New York when he was on his PhD, I believe. He did bent grass, again, color quality, ball roll disease. This is gray snow mold increase with increasing K. And you're looking on the x-axis, we have K application rates from, I'm not going to do this in my head, but he has seven different levels of potassium, and he's applying potassium every 2 weeks. And on the y-axis, we have percent plot area affected by gray snow mold. And it goes from at 0% of, and we have several different panels from March, April of each year, 2003 and 4. We have 4 different panels here. And we applied no potassium. Each year had the least amount of microdocium. When you applied 6 potassium, each year had the most, going all the way up to about 100% of the area affected when there was 6 pounds in March of 2003, 40, 50% of the area affected in April 2003 when 6 pounds of K were applied versus, say, 10 when zero was applied, and so forth. You can go through and see this. So it goes anywhere from, you know, you're increasing it depending on the season, the right conditions, and so forth. It could go as low as, say, let's see what this is. This is probably 15% from zero potassium all the way up to almost 40% when 6 pounds of K. I'm sorry, I'm not 6 pounds. I misspoke. Six grams per square meter every 2 weeks. So whatever that is, a pound and a half a K, something like that. Pound and a half a K every 2 weeks. Okay, so and it's a direct linear. I mean, the R squared is 0.98. You'd be lucky to get a 0.98 in a lab. Okay, he got a 0.98 in the field. Okay, for my science buddies and students listening, you know how hard that is. It's not easy to get. You know, we do calibrations and we do standard curves and stuff in the lab. We base everything off of 3.9s, right? 0.999. That's what you have to start off on in order to start running samples on an instrument. He got a 0.98 in the field. Okay. That's convincing. Okay. You're very likely increasing the risk of gray snow mold on bent in New York by applying high rates of potassium. Okay. Let's look at the next one. Effect of potassium on dollar spot. We've also looked at this one. This is in Agronomy Journal 87. I think this was the Curl paper 1987 when he was applying 1 pound, 2 pounds, or 4 pounds of K per year. And he's looking at infection on a 1 to 10 scale from May, June, and August on Bermuda grass. We were on cool season grasses there for a while now, guys. Now we're on Bermuda grass back again. And we see most of the time nothing happened in June or August when you applied 1, 2, or 4 pounds of K. But in May, he actually did measure an increase in dollar spot on Tifway Bermuda grass, going from 1 pound of K to 4 pounds of K per year. So this, again, is, I'm not saying this would happen, but clearly you have the potential of increasing your risk of diseases, even on warm season grasses. But it's not all bad, okay? Not all potassium applications can be bad in terms of disease, you know, problems. You know, the idea is that, you know, we're applying potassium to reduce disease risk. You know, that was the claim at the beginning, remember? It'll reduce disease occurrence, you know, the disease stress, it'll reduce it. Well, I'm showing example after example after example where it increases the risk of disease. There is a little bit on the other end as well. Okay. This is a paper in Agronomy Journal 2018. I think this was in Anthracnose, if I remember. I'll have to go over this again when I get to that paper as a standalone paper in the channel. And we're looking at months on the x-axis, June, July, August, and September, and turf area infected on the y-axis going from 0 to 60 on two different panels. I can't remember if this was two different years or what, but it has no potassium, potassium chloride, potassium sulfate, potassium carbonate, or potassium nitrate. And you see with no potassium that the area infected with anthracnose was about 50% in August. But when you applied potassium, it reduced it down to about 20% or so, about 15-20% of the area was infected with anthracnose. And give or take, you see about the same thing happen the following year, okay? You saw that the highest amount of anthracnose occurred when no potassium was applied, and you saw a reduction in anthracnose when potassium was applied. Same study, you're looking at relative area under the disease progress curve, and you see the malic 3 potassium in the turfgrass mat. You see that there's a smaller area under the disease progress curve when the malic 3 exceeds about 45. And you see a greater percent, that's what these dots are, that's what these quadrants are. These dots here are saying that there's a larger area, relative area under the disease progress curve is greater when the potassium drops below about 45 or 50. Okay, and yesterday or the day before yesterday, I was saying tissue samples are not very useful for me to make fertilizer application recommendations, but they can be useful for other things when you're trying to identify certain problems. And this is one of them where the tissue K are about 1.9%, around 2% or so tissue K. When you get below that, you're going to increase the risk. And this is relative area under the disease progress curve for anthracnose, if I remember. And you have the potential of increasing your risk when your tissue K drops below about 2%. And you see a much lower area under the curve when you're above 2%, say 2 to 3% in the tissue. So I don't use tissue K, nor do I recommend using tissue K to apply fertilizer. Okay. It's usually ran by charlatans. It's usually ran by salesmen who are grifters trying to steal your money, basically. They may not actually know it doesn't work, but I'm here letting you know. Do not base fertilizer applications of potassium on tissue K. Okay, don't do it. There's very little evidence to support it. It's just a means to convince you to buy that product. And then what they'll say is, oh, no one makes any potassium money off potassium. No one makes any money off potassium. You know, we're just here to help. No. Believe me, they're making money off of it. All right, they wouldn't be there if they're not. But don't get convinced that because they're showing you a low potassium on your tissue that you should buy and apply potassium. But this is an example where if I'm trying to identify a problem, why am I having so much anthracnose? What's going on here? This can help me diagnose that. And that's what I've been saying over the last several days about tissue potassium levels, is that you can use it in some instances, and this is one of those instances. So why does applying potassium sometimes increase the risk of disease? And I dare say that some of this is going to be new to even scientists. I was reading a book a little while ago and I came across a very interesting graph, and I have no idea if it's relevant to turf grass. I'm saying that before I even show the graph, guys, okay, gals. But for all the disease specialists and pathologists in the world, the Paul Kochs of the world, and all these people who are excellent and pathologists, you know, the Phil Harmons of the world, and they're really intelligent people. I have no idea if this is relevant to turfgrass, so don't crucify me if I'm wrong. But there may be something going on with some hormones as high and low potassium levels exist. So let's look at this. I don't think anybody really knows why. So the question is, why does applying potassium sometimes increase the risk of disease? I don't think anybody really knows why it's increasing the risk yet, but it seems to me it's possible, at least worthy of exploration, the idea that increasing potassium in the leaves may increase the presence of putrescine. Now, I'm looking at a graph here of relative growth of apple seedlings published by Hoffman and Semisch in 1971, where they showed the potassium in the leaves, as the potassium in the leaves are around 1%, they maximize the relative growth of these apple seedlings and they minimize the presence of putrescine. But as they continue to increase the potassium in the leaves, they decreased the growth of the apple seedlings as the putrescine increased. And also on the low end, as the potassium decreased, putrescine increased and growth decreased. So it's this U-shaped curve that exists with potassium. This is on apple seedlings, not turf grass. But there's this U-shaped curve that it seems to exist. Now, I don't know if potassium is resulting in putrescine increases, or if there's some rot or decay in the grass and that's resulting in the putrescine and just happens to be related in some way. But there seems to be something here where we see relative growth decline both at high and low levels of potassium, and we see putrescine levels increase at both high and low levels of potassium in the leaf. So what is putrescine? It's a polyamine produced when amino acids decompose in decaying tissue. Is associated with low K and high K and may play a role in the plant's resistance to abiotic stresses. Thus, putrescine may be an indicator that the plant is under stress. I'm just saying that seems worthy of exploration to me, to see if that's actually what's going on. Is that why both at low and at high potassium levels we see risks of some diseases occurring? Right. There's this happy Goldilocks zone with potassium. It seems to me that we need to stay, 30, 40, 50 parts per million. We don't want to be really low. We don't want to be really high. But it's, that may be why. I don't know. So why do many people claim to observe a beneficial response to potassium? I sent out a tweet years ago and I asked, have you ever seen a response to potassium? And there's a lot of people, I think it was like 60% of people said they saw a response to potassium. I believe you saw a response to a potassium fertilizer, but for me to be convinced that you actually saw a response to potassium, it's going to take an inordinate amount of evidence because it's exceedingly rare. But why do people claim this? I think it's because of this. What I'm looking at is a photograph of Kentucky bluegrass here in Lexington, Kentucky, where I applied 35 pounds of potassium per acre as potassium sulfate, and I see a bright green rectangle on this Kentucky bluegrass. So that might be why people say, hey, I saw a response to applying potassium. I put out potassium sulfate and I saw a bright green square, and I did too. I'm showing you right now on the screen. There's a green rectangle with 35 pounds per acre of potassium as potassium sulfate. But right below it, there's 35 pounds per acre of potassium as potassium chloride, and it's brown. It's suffering. It's really deficient. Not doing well at all. And so what this tells me is that people who think they might be seeing a response to potassium are probably actually seeing a response to sulfate, because when we just look at potassium, in this case of potassium chloride, we don't see those responses. We see responses to potassium sulfate. So I think that's probably why. I think they're probably just mistaken. They don't realize they're mistaken. And I don't think even some scientists have yet appreciated the magnitude that you can actually see a response from sulfate. You can really see a bright, bright green square out there just from sulfate in some locations. Okay. Especially if you get down below, you know, down low single digit sulfate, malic three sulfate numbers. You're in the single digits. That's I'm starting to be concerned about single digit sulfate numbers. Okay. This was the single digit at that location. I had 5 parts per million malic three sulfur. That's what I had at that location. And that was the response, bright green square to sulfate. So in summary, increased rooting is unlikely from potassium. Increased drought tolerance is possible, but unlikely when soil K is sufficient. Potassium may decrease risk of low temperature kill. Remember, we showed that very clearly. But it's usually on low K soils, and the benefit occurs at the lowest potassium rate. You don't need to apply a lot. Potassium increased wear tolerance or recovery is unlikely, especially when potassium is already sufficient. An applied K can decrease or increase disease risk. So simply applying potassium because you're convinced that it's going to decrease your disease risk is pretty presumptuous. I mean, what disease? You know, you need to know what disease it is. What's the soil K? You know, you need a lot of things before applying potassium would be a wise decision to reduce your risk of disease, right? Before I go, I'm going to read the chat real quick, but I'm going to leave you when I leave with one of my favorite quotes from one of my favorite movies, followed by one of my favorite songs by a band. I've seen them back, 30 years ago. I'm not a huge fan of theirs, but I do like this particular song that was intended to be an instrumental that they ended up putting words to. But that's what I'll leave you with. Anything in the chat before I go, guys and gals? I don't see anything. So if there's nothing, I will let you go. It's already 10:30. I'll be back on Monday morning and we'll continue to go over potassium. I appreciate everybody for showing up. Enjoy the music at the end. I hope you like it. See you. Bye.